Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. On this podcast, we're going to talk about some more exercise-related case reports. You guys made it very clear that you liked this format a lot, so we decided to record another one. We'll be sprinkling these episodes in the future, so don't worry, this isn't going to become the only Barbell Medicine-type podcast, but we do appreciate the feedback. As a reminder, case reports are write-ups of real patients' clinical presentations and their course of care. So while some of these are not so great sounding, yeah, this is a real patient too, so we don't want to make light of what went on. Now, I'll present them piece by piece to Dr. Baraki as a sort of mystery case and finish off the diagnosis, what happened to the patient, and any important teaching points. Speaking of Dr. Baraki, I got the second most handsome doctor in North America on the other end of the line. Dr. Baraki, what's going on, dude?
Hey, doing well. I agree. I got some positive feedback on that last episode, and I suppose it really motivated you to turn up the heat and stump me. So here we are.
Yeah, like I wanted to ease you into it, you know, make you feel okay. Good about your diagnostic acumen. But my prediction, before, as I said before we started recording, I think 1 for 3, and I that's kind of generous. And this has nothing against you. I really, you know, after last time,
sometimes things are hard.
Yeah. Okay.
We don't always get the diagnosis. That's you know, fact of life.
Yeah. There's also like a fatalities journal that I was deep into. Reading about some stuff. The problem is for those where the outcomes are obviously, you know, that's predicted due to the journal name. It's just mostly trauma, right? Which to me is less interesting. It's like, you know, person drops a barbell on their chest, rips a hole in their ventricle and, you know, bleeds out. It's like, well, there's not really any teaching point there other than like, spot. Yeah, man, spot, safeties, stuff like that. Yeah. So, yeah, it is, I think, to find stuff that's more, I guess, what would you say, medically interesting, you know, either that or like torn rotator cuff due to, you know, pushing a prowler. Like there's a case report on that, which I was like, interesting mechanism of injury, but I suppose that could happen. But, you know, besides those, like finding actually medically interesting stuff.
Yeah. That are not so overtly obvious as far as the physiology of the problem, like direct traumatic injury.
Yeah, almost got a case on here. I thought about doing this case. It was a cardiomyopathy complicated by sarcoidosis that presented after initial bout of resistance training. And
why did you choose to not present that one? That sounds very much up my alley.
It's gonna come up later, but the reason why is that the actual case write-up was so minimal that I would actually have to fabricate, you know, a real physical exam and, you know, whatever, how this would present.
You're free to
and
I'm do like, that. Fine.
I know. Yeah. I was going to take some liberties, but these cases, I think, were a little bit better fleshed out. So question is, are you ready?
Ready as I'm going to be.
All right. Case number one, 30-year-old male active duty member of the Air Force presented to the emergency department with sudden onset shortness of breath and chest pain that occurred while bench pressing approximately 80 kilograms. The patient reports that the chest pain is on his left side only, and he's never had this before. He is short of breath. He denies any medical history, smoking, or recent travel. Now, before we go further, any thoughts on this initial workup that you'd like to see done?
Sure. So, if you may have recalled from the previous episode, a theme of when you presented me with a given concern, I took a moment and ignored all the other history around it and discussed just how I would think about that particular concern, right? And so the medical trainees in the audience, this will be a little familiar to them. To the rest, this is, again, a little bit more of an illustration, I suppose, of how the clinical thought process goes. But when we have two concerns like this, chest pain and shortness of breath, that really is something that localizes the site of the pathology to the chest. Something's going on in the chest. In the overwhelming majority of cases with this kind of a concern. And so I'll take them separately. The chest pain can be something that we attribute to the heart, and the heart has multiple different structures, all of which can generate contribute to a painful experience. The pericardium, the myocardium, you know, the coronaries, various other aspects of the heart. And then we have the lungs, which can get irritated or injured in various ways. There can be inflammation in the lungs. There can be infection. There can be collapse of the lung. There can be blood clots in the lungs. So that's heart and lungs. There are, can also be issues with the esophagus, the gastrointestinal system, leading to chest pain. That's a little bit less likely to cause shortness of breath, but still can in certain other ways. So things like the esophagus, the stomach, et cetera. And then we have the chest wall. And so that's the ribs and the muscles and things like that around it. So those are, you know, the big picture, of course, the skin overlying it. Those are all kind of structures that in various ways can become inflamed or irritated, or can have nociception going on, leading to the experience of pain. And then separately from that, shortness of breath is something that often also relates to either the heart or the lungs, or in, you know, some situations, things like anemia and things like that. And so similar pathologies affecting the heart and the lungs can also lead to shortness of breath. And so in a young, healthy, exercising person, certain types of pathologies can increase in probability, whereas others might tend to decrease, in particular those that we might see in slightly older individuals. But at the same time, young patients can experience just about anything for bad luck, or because they have some undiagnosed or undetected risk factors. And so these are situations where it's a bit early in the case to hypothesize very specific causes or pathologies, but rather I'm just taking a bird's eye view of the chest cavity and trying to localize or overlap things that can lead to both pain and shortness of breath. And so I'm very fixated on the heart and lungs. And so my next steps here would involve looking at the vital signs, doing a physical exam on this patient, getting an electrocardiogram, and probably a chest x-ray would be the first steps to come.
Well, ask and you shall receive. So the patient is sitting upright in bed on physical exam. He is on supplemental oxygen, although they don't report how many liters, but he is on nasal cannula, and he does report mild pain over his left chest. He does otherwise appear well and is in no apparent distress. Vital signs, including respiratory rate and O2 saturation, were within normal limits in the ED. Again, he's on supplemental oxygen. Chest exam revealed normal excursion of the chest with no use of accessory muscles for breathing. No trauma was observed. The trachea was midline and not deviated. No tactile fremitus or vibration was observed during respiration. Now, auscultation of his lungs revealed decreased breath sounds at the apex of the left lung. No abnormal breath sounds were otherwise noted. His cardiac exam was normal, and his EKG was unremarkable. Any sort of narrowing of your differential diagnosis, Dr. Baraki?
Yeah, I should have mentioned in the first section when he described a very specific localization to his pain. He said it's very localized on the left side. That actually would be helpful compared to somebody who just has kind of generalized pain in the chest or isn't really able to pinpoint it. And especially in a young person like this, potentially one who's active in some way, that really makes me think much more about the pleural surface. The pleura is the surface of the lung, and potentially something like a collapsed lung or a pneumothorax would be increasing in probability. The physical exam has some useful features here, like maybe they heard some slightly decreased breath sounds, some not so useful features. Again, the medical trainees will be familiar with some of the terms like tactile fremitus and things like that, which are not particularly useful exam maneuvers to reduce the probability of certain things. So I care a little bit less about that. I do think that, you know, the normal electrocardiogram is great. I would want to either put an ultrasound probe on this patient's chest and take a look at his lungs, or get a chest x-ray, or both potentially to further assess in particular the lungs, because that's moving higher on my list of suspicions. The other types of conditions that I mentioned that can affect the lungs, like infection, for example, or a blood clot in the lungs, those would not be things that I would expect to have significant impact on whether or not you hear breath sounds in a given area. And so I'm just kind of entertaining the possibility that maybe the decreased breath sounds is indicative of exactly what we're worried about here, like a collapsed lung or pneumothorax, or maybe it was just the examiner's ears are bad and they just thought they heard that, but it's incidental and the actual problem is something else, because that's frequently the case as well.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. One of the texts that I used during not only medical school, but particularly in residency, that I think would be useful for our medical audience, particularly learners, but if you're also medically curious, especially for whatever reason about the physical exam and like how that may like indicate the probability of one thing over another, I always reference this book called Sapira's Art and Science of Bedside Diagnosis. It's a very extensive deep dive into not only how to perform various physical exam maneuvers, but also like their sensitivity and specificity for actually identifying things. And some of the tests you would say, oh, this would definitely be a really good test to do on physical exam. And then you see the actual, you know, evidence on it and you're like, oh, less. But also even things like, what is tactile fremitus, right? Like we say it, I remember in med school, you just learn the term and you're like, oh, other people were saying that, or like rails, ronchi, wheezing. And you're like, what are all these terms? Like, what does that actually refer to? And it has like a historical view on like when this term came into the lexicon, what it actually means, and the acoustical characteristic in these particular cases, which I think is interesting. But if you're not a medical trainee or otherwise curious about this, like forget that book recommendation. If you are, Sapira's Art and Science to Bedside Diagnosis, 10 out of 10 would recommend if that's something you're interested in.
Yeah, putting an ultrasound on this patient would be a lot more useful than a lot of those maneuvers. But that aside, carry
on. Yeah. So they got a chest x-ray and it showed a left apical primary spontaneous pneumothorax. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say that saying the x-ray showed a primary spontaneous pneumothorax is kind of a misnomer because you couldn't really say that it's primary from just a chest x-ray. You just see a pneumothorax in this particular area. And then you have to kind of suss out, like, why did this person have it? So it's kind of interesting they labeled that as the diagnosis already. But in any case, the course for this patient, he was admitted, placed on oxygen. They actually put an 8 French chest tube in him. And that refers to the French scale for the outer diameter of the catheter, which is really interesting. I don't know. Have you ever gone down the rabbit hole, like how they named these things?
Many years ago, but I don't recall the details.
So like
of that.
eight, the number refers to the numerator and it's always divided by 3. So for whatever it is, if it's 9 French, well, it's 9 divided by 3 and it gives you a measurement of the outer diameter in millimeters. So 8 divided by 3 is 2.6 millimeters. That's the outer diameter of this particular chest tube. And that was placed and overnight to drain the pneumothorax. CT scan of the chest the following day demonstrated a complete resolution of the pneumothorax without any evidence of any pleural blebs, which is one of my favorite medical terms, just the idea of a bleb, because you're like, well, what is a bleb? And it's like, anatomize this. If you just like had to describe a bleb.
Yeah, it's like a little bubble in the lung, I guess. And so it would pop and you would get air in the space where air is not supposed to be. And that leads to the collapsed lung effectively, which is the kind of layperson term for this condition that this patient had, leading to the pain, leading to the need for supplemental oxygen and the shortness of breath. So this would be a pretty typical presentation of this kind of a condition. I've seen this many times over the years, and putting them on oxygen and depending on the size, whether or not they need a chest tube is exactly what would be done for these like 10 out of 10 times.
Yep. He was discharged home and at outpatient follow-up 1 month later, he remained asymptomatic. Repeat chest x-ray showed no pneumothorax recurrence. So the pearls here that I wanted to talk about was like, one, what is spontaneous pneumothorax? And the other one is just shortness of breath during exercise. I think you actually covered the idea of like shortness of breath in general, but shortness of breath during exercise is kind of a specialized period of time because you expect during high intensity exercise for there to be at least some shortness of breath. So exercise causing shortness of breath is not really like diagnostic of anything. It's more so when it is disproportionate to the type of effort, right? There's an increase in metabolic demands anytime you undergo physical activity. But when the, you know, dyspnea or shortness of breath is out of proportion to the challenge, or it persists after cessation of the activity and or occurs with other signs and symptoms, like something like chest pain, for example, mm-hmm. you start wondering about other causes. And to your point earlier, the differential for this is broad. Cardiac, you know, from the heart, you could think about somebody having a heart attack. They have heart failure. There's something else going on there. In the respiratory system itself, could anything from a embolism, a clot, bronchospasm, some sort of infection, some sort of disease process, you know, within the lungs themselves, asthma, COPD, et cetera. Could be anatomical. Did somebody have a paralysis, partial paralysis of their diaphragm? Do they have an intra-abdominal process, space-occupying sort of lesion? Are they very, very pregnant, which you would be able to, you know, see on exam, for example? Neurological causes. There are also systemic causes relating to anemia, kidney failure, thyroid disease, whatever. And even anxiety, you know, when there's really no biomedical sort of reason for this. So there are many different causes for shortness of breath. But when you focus it during exercise, the main key here is that it's out of proportion to what somebody is doing.
Or the other consideration is if somebody was previously able to tolerate a given level, degree, intensity, or amount of exercise, and that has decreased, not due to just routine detraining, then that's something else that raises concern. So this is a typical question I might ask somebody if they're having, you know, shortness of breath, for example, and I might try to quantify that in a way by saying, like, what's the hardest thing that you might do in a given day? And they're like, oh, well, I used to be able to run 2 miles. And I'm like, well, okay, well, how much could you run now? And they're like, a block. Okay, well, we have a clear sense of the degree of decline here. And that's quite alarming, particularly for somebody who was previously able to do that and now can't.
Yep. As far as spontaneous pneumothorax, all right, so just a basic anatomy lesson here. The lungs reside in the chest, specifically in the thoracic cavity. They are covered, like Austin alluded to, by a layer of tissue that's called the visceral pleura, which is continuous with an outer layer of tissue that attaches to the chest wall, the inside of the chest wall, called the parietal pleura. There's a small amount of pleural fluid contained within this pleural space. This aids in lung movement during inspiration and expiration. When you get gas in this space, that's called a pneumothorax. It typically presents with chest pain, shortness of breath, which is also called dyspnea, and asymmetrical chest expansion if the amount of gas that's entered the space is large enough. Now, spontaneous pneumothoraces, just multiple pneumothoraxes, occur without trauma, most commonly in young, tall, thin men who smoke. These small pleural blebs on the superior outer surface of the upper lobes. That's the most common location. This can also be a complication of common lung diseases like COPD, asthma, interstitial lung disease, and emphysema. Also, more rarely, things like tuberculosis, sarcoidosis, cystic fibrosis, some infections, things of that nature. But conditions like Marfan's disease and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which are abnormal elastin or collagen content of the pleura itself, may predispose folks to having this as well. Exercise and illicit drug use, so things like cocaine, heroin, et cetera, may increase the risk of these things rupturing. This is based on case reports. It's thought that an exercise, the Valsalva maneuver, which increases not only intra-abdominal pressure, but also intra-thoracic pressure because the lungs in general are expanded and you also have some tension on the chest wall itself, may contribute to the actual rupturing. But again, this is only in case reports, so hard to really feel super confident about that. And then I think most commonly when we were coming up through medical school, it's like a thin man who smokes, who's either been scuba diving or like recently been traveling by plane. And you're like, oh, that should clue you in that some atmospheric pressure change has contributed to the rupturing of one of these blebs.
Yeah, exactly. And it leads to sudden onset chest pain. And that is very, very typically very localized. Like they could point a finger at where this discomfort tends to be and then associates with shortness of breath would be a very common manifestation of this, as it was in this case. Although I will say again, there are several other conditions that can also lead to sudden onset pinpoint chest pain and associated shortness of breath, which is why I didn't jump. A pneumothorax was on the list very early on, but I was not prepared to say, hey, final diagnosis after like the first sentence.
Yeah. As far as treatment goes, this depends on the severity. There's algorithms, treatment algorithms, based on things like pain, stability of the patients, so that includes respiratory rate, oxygen saturation rate, et cetera. But those sort of symptoms are usually commensurate with the size of the pneumothorax. Bigger ones lead to greater instability, require more intervention in general, and smaller things can, you know, people don't actually need medical care, just usually monitoring. Sometimes you use a chest tube to relieve the pressure if it's big enough. Generally needs repeat imaging, like a chest x-ray to see if everything's resolved. And if it recurs, which is the estimates vary for how often these things recur. Usually 10 to 30% is the most commonly quoted sort of figure. They may need a surgical pleurodesis with blebectomy, another great word, to actually adhere the pleura together. And so you kind of obliterate that space so you can't get any more of these blebs that would otherwise rupture. The last thing I'll say about this, you know, because this implicates exercise as sort of like provocative or inciting event due to maybe a Valsalva maneuver. So people will then say, well, look, if you think you might be at risk of this, why don't you just not do the Valsalva maneuver? And this is something that it recently came up on our Facebook group and occasionally rears its head from time to time when people start talking about the Valsalva, like you have a choice in performing the Valsalva during exercise. And multiple data sets show that when the effort becomes challenging enough, somewhere around 80% of maximal voluntary contraction, that's not 80% of your 1RM, that's literally like 80% of how much force that your muscle can produce. So it might be much lighter than 80% of 1RM because your muscle is just trying to produce force kind of indiscriminately to coordinate with this complex movement. Or if you get close to failure on a lighter set, so higher rep, lower load, sort of thing. In any case, you're going to do a Valsalva. it's a reflexive sort of movement that you do, and so that you can produce more force. You don't have a choice in this. When people are like, oh, you should breathe in during the concentric and breathe out during the eccentric, it's like, even if you coach somebody to do that, and they did this in a study, multiple studies, in fact, they'll do a Valsalva when the effort gets hard.
So yeah. So effectively, if that's your recommendation, you're just telling people to cap their effort, you know, below a certain level indefinitely, which is a recommendation you could make. I don't know how strongly kind of evidence-based it would be. These things sometimes happen, whether or not you're exercising even. I mean, I would say that, you know, I've seen a lot of pneumothoraces over the years, and the overwhelming majority did not occur in the context of exercise. But that's, you know, is what it is.
That'd be a good problem to have, but we suddenly find all of these like adverse reactions to exercise because so many people are exercising.
Right,
but yeah, maybe due to like the low amount of participation in general and relatively low overall risk combined of exercise, you just don't really see that. But in any case, when people are like, oh, don't do a Valsalva, you don't really have a choice unless things are very, very easy, which is a way to exercise, but in general, not our recommended sort of exercise guidelines. Okay, good. That was the one out of three that I thought you were going to get.
Yeah, I hope so, because that was very easy.
So now we enter the danger zone. We'll see what you have here. All right, this one, I'm 90% sure that you're not going to get it. But
all right,
like, 27-year-old male presents to a primary care clinic for his, quote, annual physical exam. Already, Austin's blood pressure is elevated. It's like, why does this guy need an annual physical exam? He reports eating a healthy diet and exercising regularly. He does not have any family, medical, or social history. He's had three previous exams within the last 3 years for, again, his annual physical exam. Now, before I go any further, and I know that you don't work in a outpatient clinic, but when a young, otherwise healthy person with no medical history effectively shows up for their annual or for an exam, anything like creep to the top of your head? Like, why is this person here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to take advantage of the opportunity to, you know, make sure that they're up to date on the things they need to be up to date on, be it, you know, blood pressure screening. I would probably check blood lipids myself, even if it is not guideline recommended for somebody in this demographic, make sure their immunizations are up to date. If they have, you know, any kind of high risk behavior in their life, that's being adequately, you know, addressed, HIV testing, et cetera, et cetera. And then, yeah, if they're coming in, I'm always going to open up with, hey, what's going on? What can we help you with? But and then if they're coming in frequently without a clear reason to, then yeah, I'm also curious as to what's prompting that. Is there something in particular they're worried about? Is there some health related anxiety? Are there some behaviors in their life that they recognize that are high risk that they have not yet revealed, and so they just keep coming in to, you know, get checked out because they're worried maybe they're repeatedly requesting, you know, sexually transmitted infection testing or something like that? Just kind of getting a sense of what isn't being discussed or revealed here, and trying to establish rapport to where we can get that information out if it's present.
Yeah, that's kind of my same line of thinking. Whenever I would see a new patient, like sort of, you know, blocked out of my schedule, that was a younger person with no real medical history, or especially one that had been there a couple times before for just a routine sort of checkup, as it were, I'm like, okay, they're either worried about something that's happened due to a person in their life, you know, life. They're like, hey, I got to make sure that I don't have this particular thing. There's some sort of either behavioral, you know, sort of thing that they're trying to make sure I'm still healthy, right? Or there's some sort of directed testing that they're looking for. So, okay, well, let's get to the physical exam and some labs and see.
There's no other history. This dude doesn't have anything else to tell us.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So
limited history.
So you're 90% sure I won't get it because this patient has no history to speak of. All right. Got it.
Well, we'll see if you get it from the exam and from the laboratory tests. Okay. So his exam, the patient has a BMI of 25. He looks well muscled. His vital signs were within normal limits, and his physical exam was ultimately unremarkable. So well appearing man. All right. Laboratory examination. Significant.
Why did we check labs? But anyway, okay.
Patient requested some labs, as it were.
All right.
And again, he's had these multiple times over the past few years. Okay. So his total cholesterol is 237 milligrams per deciliter. His triglycerides are 76. His LDL is 198. And his HDL is 24. His liver function tests are significant for an AST of 75, an ALT of 144, normal bilirubin. Subsequently, they sent out tests for hepatitis A, B, and C. Those were all negative. His total testosterone was 145 nanograms per deciliter. 2 years prior, it was 486. His luteinizing hormone was low. 2 years prior, it was normal. And his FSH is low. 2 years prior, it was normal. Any other thoughts here? I see you lean in like you're actively thinking about what could possibly be going on with this person.
Yeah, I'm also trying to focus to keep all these numbers in my head since I don't have them up in front of me. So if I recall some, the first thing was the lipid panel. I'll just work through these kind of in order from what I recall. So he had some hyperlipidemia and very low HDL cholesterol, which can manifest from a variety of different things. One is just, we can see that a lot in metabolic syndrome, patients with insulin resistance, diabetes, et cetera, can lead to elevations in blood. LDL cholesterol and reductions in HDL cholesterol. In that context, I'd expect the triglycerides to be a little higher. And so that doesn't entirely fit. The other context in which we can see elevations in LDL and reductions in HDL cholesterol is in anabolic substance related, issues. So people using steroids for various reasons. Those are just a couple scenarios. There are certainly others, but those are the first two things that I tend to think of if I see that type of pattern. The next thing you mentioned is the elevated liver related enzymes. The transaminases were elevated. That can happen for a whole host of things, infections, inflammatory or autoimmune conditions, drug toxicity from medications, or again, anabolic substance related issues, and then certain other less common conditions, infiltrative things and things that we don't need to get into on this version of the Barbell Medicine podcast. And so far, after I heard those first couple sets of things, I did have some suspicion between the cholesterol panel. You said his BMI is 25. I didn't get the sense that his waist measurement is super elevated or that he's very high risk from that standpoint, that was leaning more in the anabolic use kind of concern from the lipid panel and the elevated transaminases as my next concern. Then you told me about his testosterone levels, which was 100 and something now, and it was 400 in the past. Which would not be consistent with him actively using testosterone, but could be reflective of suppression of that axis from either current or prior use of anabolic steroids, leading to hypogonadism, say he was using for a while and then came off or something like that. So that's also a possibility. The next thing you told me was that his FSH and his LH, I believe, were both suppressed. Is that correct? And those are hormones that come from the pituitary gland in your brain and signal the testes to produce testosterone. And so those are things that would tend to get suppressed in a couple different scenarios. But if somebody had hypogonadism or low testosterone because their testes were no longer producing testosterone, those numbers would go way up. LH and FSH would increase to compensate and kind of bring that level back up to normal. When we see a low testosterone like this gentleman has in the 150-ish range, which is quite low, right? Quite low, and low FSH and LH, I'm worried more about secondary hypogonadism or in very, very rare cases, tertiary, which is a fringe case. So that brings me to focus a bit more on his pituitary gland and then other things that can also lead to secondary hypogonadism. Most commonly, we see that with things like obesity, bad obstructive sleep apnea, chronic opioid use, things like that can lead to that, or something in the pituitary gland, for example, like a pituitary adenoma, for example, something that can mess with pituitary function, lead to decreases in FSH and LH, and lead to decrease in testosterone downstream. And in fact, if I have somebody who I am suspicious of symptomatic clinical hypogonadism who has a testosterone level below 150, I'm typically getting or recommending a brain MRI for them to look for or rule out the possibility of something like a pituitary adenoma. I think those were most of the labs that I remember. What else was there after the FSH and LH?
Nope, that was it. So in fact, the clinician that this person saw was all ready to order a brain MRI for their workup for some potential infectious etiologies that would affect the transaminases and
let me pause you. Let me pause you before you get to that point, before you reveal anything else, because I want to make sure I had all the information. So now I'm at a point where if I have a patient with I'm kind of doing a clinical reasoning exercise here, juggling both what I would suspect to be some kind of pituitary related endocrine disorder leading to hypogonadism and some sort of liver related finding. The first thing that comes to mind when I think about that is something like hereditary hemochromatosis. Which would be, this patient was pretty young, I believe, mm-hmm. right? He was like in his, how old, 20s, something like that?
25.
Mm-hmm. That's very young.
Sorry. Yep.
Yeah, that'd be very young for something like this to manifest. That is a condition where patients can get iron overload in their body, and that iron overload can deposit in various organs, including the pituitary, can deposit in the liver, can deposit in the heart, and then in certain other tissues like the pancreas and in the skin. And it can lead to various manifestations, including liver disease, heart disease, low testosterone, diabetes, and these people get super, super tan. And so that's, if I'm trying to think about this in other ways besides the original concern in this young person without any other history, anabolic use would be like number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, on the list of concerns for something like this. If this patient were, you know, a couple decades older, and I was very confident that that was not a part of the puzzle here, that anabolic use wasn't on the hook, then I'd be digging a little further into other infiltrative conditions is what we would call them. So things like hemochromatosis or sarcoidosis or amyloidosis, things like that, just other more similar fringe kind of diagnoses that come up in these types of mystery case discussions.
Yeah. Apparently, so the great clinical reasoning. This is very instructive for our listeners. It's also entertaining. And again, the clinician who this individual saw was apparently ready to, you know, fire a shotgun at this man as far as a workup goes. Like you know, again, brain MRI, TSH, full infectious workup, and potentially looking at some other infiltrative disorders. However, prior to these labs and tests being sent for, the patient admitted to use of selective androgen receptor modulators, SARMs, for the previous 8 weeks. He was subsequently counseled to cease using these due to the liver toxicity that was apparently seen in his labs, in addition to his low testosterone levels. And after 3 weeks, that follow-up showed a normalization of his lipids, and a two-month follow-up showed a resolution of his liver function tests. So I'm giving you one half point.
It sounds to me like he was using an anabolic substance, and I believe I said anabolics was number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on my
list.
That's
true.
So I'm claiming credit for this one.
All right, that's fine. I'm going to give you a half. You can get one. That's fine. I think the more interesting thing is that the picture of SARM ingestion is a little bit different than traditional anabolic steroid use, particularly as most steroid cycles, PED cycles, will have some sort of testosterone agent as its sort of base. And mm-hmm. so when you see the low testosterone, I think that would throw a lot of clinicians off base because they're either not aware that SARMs exist and or are being used recreationally for this purpose. And so seeing that might trigger this sort of exhaustive workup that would still not identify the actual thing, particularly if the patient wasn't forthcoming with this information, which brings up a whole other discussion about, like, you know, doctor patient confidentiality, rapport, trust, you know, things of that nature. But yeah, this individual was taking two separate SARMs for about 8 weeks prior to showing up. And yeah, some interesting results here. So the pearls I wanted to talk about here were both relating to SARM safety and SARMs, just like, what are they? It's sort of like, hey, if you didn't know these things existed, like, here they are. And also liver function tests, because we've talked about this before, but a recent question on our forum made me want to, like, rehash these. So let's start off with SARMs. So SARMs are, that's an acronym, stands for Selective Androgen Receptor Modulator. These were discovered over 20 years ago, so in the 90s, and they were thought to have a high potential to replace testosterone therapy in men and revolutionize the treatment of muscle wasting and poor muscle function in both sexes. Now, despite this long-standing history and the hype around these things, to date, not a single SARM has been approved for clinical use. Now, SARMs bind to the receptors in specific tissues on their androgen receptors to cause an effect, whereas things like testosterone bind to all androgen receptors body-wide, potentially causing additional side effects and risk in many individuals. Now, SARMs are not a steroid. They do not aromatize, which means they cannot be metabolized to estrogen or DHT or other sort of intermediates. And for these reasons, some have predicted and even promoted that SARMs are safer and better than testosterone supplementation, though the existing evidence does not really support this. There's a couple lines of evidence that we'll cover here. So first, a number of testosterone's effects are due to its effect on estrogen. So increasing the estrogen slightly seems to be beneficial for bone mass, for libido, other sexual function. And SARMs don't do this in general, making it less clear that they would help with any of these things. Next, SARMs seem to inhibit the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, actually lowering testosterone and estrogen levels as seen in our patient. Now, if you are unaware of SARMs or like the fact that there are anabolics out there that do this in general, again, a clinician might be like, huh, and just refer somebody to endocrinology, which may be appropriate just based on the level of clinical training and experience, but that's an interesting sort of little factoid here. And the efficacy of SARMs You know, they've been in phase two and phase three clinical trials, but again, have not been approved for use. They've only shown a small to modest effect on muscle mass. And I want to be specific on muscle mass, which is an outcome. But when you talk about people with like not only muscle wasting disease, but poor function, you really want to see an improvement in muscle mass and function. There's been no consistent improvement in function shown in men or women with any of the SARMs that have currently been tested in phase two or phase three clinical trials. Also of note, there does not appear to be a dose-dependent relationship in SARMs and muscle mass, whereas that is observed with testosterone supplementation at superphysiological doses. We know that the higher amount of testosterone that people take, the more muscle mass and strength they tend to gain, but that is not the relationship seen with SARMs. In fact, the only dose-dependent relationship that we see with SARMs is with liver toxicity.
Yeah, the harms.
Exactly, which seem to increase with higher doses. Now, SARMs are banned by the World Anti-Doping Association, WADA, but are being used by both competitive and recreational athletes alike. It's hard to know real numbers here, but a recent web-based survey in men who have used anabolic steroids showed that 1 in 7 reported use of SARMs within the past year. They're also being heavily marketed by influencers and other non-experts as they're promoted as being safe alternatives to anabolic steroids, which is not really consistent with either the case presented here or the available evidence. Also, SARMs are patented medications that are not currently available for clinical use. So when people are like, oh, I got prescriptions, you know, SARM, well, a particular SARM that by prescription, it's like, well, how did you get that? But they're readily available on the internet nonetheless. And actually, studies have looked at their sort of purity. And when looking at some of these available agents, I believe this particular study was on 44 different SARMs that they purchased over the internet. 10% didn't contain any SARM at all. 40% were tainted with adulterants, including things like opiates and benzodiazepines. Only half contained any SARM at all. Most of the time, not even the SARM that was on the label. Also, SARMs are illegal, just as an aside, based on the Designer Anabolic Steroid Control Act of 2014. So it's not like you can just have them with no consequences. But thanks to this underground market, they are kind of widely available. But I do think that the clinical knowledge is even lower for SARMs than it is for anabolic steroids in general. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't think that most clinicians, if you ask them, would be aware that these things existed.
What a SARM is, but they don't know what a SARM
exactly.
is.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And in this case, you know, it is interesting to point out, as you said, the picture that a clinician who doesn't know about these things might expect is, oh, if he was on anabolics, his testosterone level would be very high. But the key to this, and this was what I was thinking throughout the case, is an anabolic agent that does not directly drive up testosterone would explain a lot of this stuff. And but you need to be familiar with these things that they exist to recognize that pattern.
Yeah. Yes. I think in one of these cases, if you had a patient who was taking this, and this can also be extended to anabolic steroids or other PEDs in general, it's more of a discussion about harm reduction and like monitoring. Right. And again, I think we talked about on the last podcast or one of our more recent podcasts, it's like, it's difficult to feel confident about like how exactly you would monitor somebody, like what particular parameters and sort of thresholds you would establish to be like, hey, at this point, we're off, right? Mm-hmm. But you would do your best by saying, well, we're just going to look broadly at stuff and kind of monitor you. And if we start seeing evidence of harm, maybe we have this, you know, agreement, a sort of faux contract, if you will, about, yeah, at this point, we would probably stop. And if you can get a patient on board with that, that seems like some pretty good harm reduction in my estimation, because you can't, these things aren't going to go away. You can't just be like, hey, stop taking them and that's it. That to me is not like, you know, a good clinical care. What do you think about that, Austin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very straightforward to negotiate in these kind of contexts that we would monitor blood counts, blood lipids, blood pressure, liver and kidney function. If I could get those, I would be like pretty satisfied. There may be on a case-by-case basis or agent-by-agent basis something else that ought to be monitored. I don't even know that. I'd be looking that up. But those five things would be things that I'd be monitoring in somebody who was choosing to use these agents and wanted to do as little harm to themselves as they could.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. All right. So let's talk about liver function tests for a little bit, particularly the transaminases. So ALT and AST. ALT standing for alkaline phosphatase and AST standing for aspartate transaminase. Now, these are liver associated enzymes. Okay. Liver associated enzymes. They're also found in heart tissue, the cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle, kidneys, brain, etc. So the elevation of AST and or ALT are not measurements of actual liver function, but they're mainly used as a general assessment of liver injury, as they can reflect liver cell injury, though again, there are other sources of these particular enzymes. Now, exercise of all types increases AST and ALT. Strength training in particular, as there tends to be a little bit more muscular damage with strength training than in conditioning type exercise. AST is typically increased chronically in individuals who resistance train, whereas ALT seems to initially go up when people undertake resistance training, but it seems to go back down towards normal levels. It seems to be some sort of adaptive trait, but it doesn't mean that people can't present with an elevated ALT as well. And these can stay elevated for up to a week after exercise, meaning like your last bout of exercise. So when people are like, oh, I have a high AST and ALT, and they exercised either that day or the day before, it's hard to make heads or tails of what that is, but I don't think you can just like wave it off as, oh, it's just exercise. You really want to make sure somebody doesn't have any underlying process that could be contributory to those sort of values. There's been some discussion about using GGT, which is like this sort of liver specific sort of enzyme, and that never really goes up with exercise related muscle damage, for example, but that's not really well established as a guideline. So if you had a person, so let's say a hypothetically 38-year-old male, well-muscled, comes into your clinic, otherwise healthy, and his AST and ALT are, you know, three times the upper limit, but everything else is fine. Do you just say, hey, did you work out yesterday? That's what you do, and you just send them on their way?
Yeah. So this is, I agree, this is an important topic because we get asked about it a lot on our group and on the forum. We have an article about it on the website. But even though there is a relationship between exercise and the elevation in these blood markers, I agree that this should not give you license to just ignore these elevations just because you are somebody who trains. In a patient who comes in that type of situation, again, lab interpretation is complex. It's why you should see a professional to do it. You are probably not qualified to interpret your own labs. And so, if I have that lab, you know, finding in front of me before the patient even comes in, the first thing I want to know is what does the rest of the liver panel look like? Because if I see other abnormalities, like his bilirubin is elevated, for example, or his INR is elevated, other things like that, then I know, okay, this ain't just exercise. This is definitely a liver or, you know, a systemic disease type problem. If everything else is super normal and those are just elevated, then my next question is, tell me what supplements or steroids you take. And if that is definitively negative, then, you know, I might go down the pathway of, okay, the bottom of the barrel is, okay, this may be related to training. My advice would be that, hey, tell me about your training schedule. You know, for me, knowing how important training might be to somebody like that, I would say, hey, when's the next time you expect to have any bit of a layoff or something like that? And they're like, well, maybe I'm taking this trip or something and I'm not gonna be able to train, whatever. Okay, can we do the lab right when you get back? when you, because otherwise asking somebody who's like motivated, hard training athlete to like, hey, can you just like stop for a week, because if somebody told me to do that, I would not love it. Now, if my transaminases were over 100, as you said, then yeah, I'd be concerned enough to do that, because even I would be reluctant to blame my elevated, you know, if they were that high, right? If it was like 45, then that's different than like 105, that's different than 505. So all of those would be have very different interpretations. So yeah.
Yeah, can you imagine if somebody says, oh, yeah, no, I got a vacation coming up. I'll come in first thing in the morning before I train. We'll get these labs done. But it's a bender of a week.
Yeah, they're going to go and drink.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I can appreciate the difficulty here. And you know, it's funny, during residency, for whatever reason, I think it's just because I was kind of known in the local community as like, oh, he's a doc and he gets it. I know this guy. A number of my patients would have AST, ALT, like, very elevated, a number of them due to some potential
chemistry
and others that was just a function of their training, right? And so when I would be discussing these cases with the attendings, and I'd tell them it very similar to what you said, like kind of my thought process here, they're ultimately unaware that AST and ALT can go up from exercise and stay up for like 5 days. And then, but to, you know, to their credit, when I would say this, they would say, well, just tell them not to work out for a week. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's a tougher sell, interestingly. Yeah, yeah. You know,
tell me you don't lift without telling me.
Especially because if you introduce this idea to the patient where it's like, hey, yeah, these could be related to exercise, and you know, they would go down theoretically within a week if you stopped exercising. To some people, they'll hear that and say, oh, well, it's just due to exercise, so let's not worry about it.
Yeah,
which is probably not the case. And this is a kind of analogous to an elevated creatinine as well. Like if somebody's creatinine is a little higher than normal, but they carry a lot of muscle mass, and you introduce the idea like, hey, this may just be due to elevated muscle mass. And they're like, great, I don't need to worry about this. And it's like, I mean, or it could be like a bunch of other stuff that's messing with your kidneys. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, tough situation. All right. For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I gotta say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid-layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code B-A-R-B-E-L-L to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of my questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Also, I should just say, you know, we're here with Dr. Austin Baracchi on the Barbell Medicine podcast, Case Files number 2. You like this. Like, you love this. Like, we've done 290 podcasts or something together.
You've been bored out of your mind on all the other ones.
I've never seen you like this. We're getting top tier, Dr. Baracchi. I love this. All right, last case. So I'm giving you a half point on the last one. You're 1.5 out of 2. That's pretty good.
I disagree, but okay.
Okay, that's fair enough. Yeah, we'll ask the crowd. The third one, I'm almost positive. If you get this, I don't know. All right, here we go. Last case, 34-year-old male presents to the emergency department with impaired vision and difficulty speaking for 1 hour. Before this episode, he was lifting weights, which he says he's recently increased. History was difficult to obtain due to word finding issues. For example, he said tree instead of pen when asking for a pen to write down answers to questions. His comprehension did not appear to be affected, as he was able to relate a history using pen and paper. He does use cannabis daily, reporting a single joint. He denies trauma, previous episodes like this, or use of anabolic steroids. So before we go any further, Austin, any thoughts? 34-year-old male presenting to the emergency department with impaired vision and difficulty speaking, particularly word-finding issues, expressive aphasia, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that similar to our first case, jumping all the way to a final diagnosis, it would be premature in the first the first step of this evaluation. But it does seem like we have a neurological syndrome. So my where I'm concerned that this disease lives is in this kid's brain. And so in that context, we have a set of neurological symptoms, vision and speaking related issues that appear to have been sudden in onset. And so there are a few different conditions that can lead to sudden onset neurological symptoms, sudden onset neurological syndromes. One, for example, would be a seizure. That's something that can be, you can be completely normal, and then suddenly you can start to experience a given neurological symptom. It can be anything under the sun. Another would be some form of a stroke. There are various kinds of strokes that we don't need to get into right now because that's not as pertinent to the diagnosis at this point, rather just concerned that a stroke could be going on. And a stroke involves a period of time when there's insufficient blood flow to a given area of the brain. And when that area of the brain doesn't get enough blood or oxygen, it starts to malfunction effectively. And whatever neurological function that area of the brain is normally in charge of starts to go wrong. So if this young patient, for example, experienced a brainstem stroke, there are certain ones of those that could lead to difficulty with vision and difficulty with speech, for example. There are also other areas of the brain that could be affected to lead to these symptoms. And then other sorts of sudden onset things, there can be like kind of cousins of strokes. So one, for example, that comes to mind is something called, there's vascular conditions that are not stroke related that can affect the brain, in particular in the context of cannabis use. I believe that can trigger something called reversible vasoconstriction, RCVS, reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome. As well, which can also manifest with neurological symptoms. But these are just a few kind of preliminary thoughts. I have this acute neurological syndrome that I would be most concerned for a vascular issue or a stroke going on in this patient. If that is in fact what we find, then the next step would be to figure out why did this stroke happen? Where did it come from? Did he have a clot in his heart for some reason that got shot up to his brain leading to the stroke? Did he have premature atherosclerosis, a cardiovascular disease that led to a run-of-the-mill stroke just in a much younger patient than usual? Did he have a dissection of one of his blood vessels, like a vertebral artery dissection that can lead to strokes in the back of the brain and lead to a variety of symptoms like this? Or is there something else causing like vasospasm, like RCVS or something like that? So the next steps for a patient like this would be to get a set of vital signs, namely paying very close attention to the blood pressure, doing a more detailed neurological exam to actually get a sense of what exactly is this impaired vision? Because I didn't get much detail on what that was. Is it blurred vision? Is it double vision? Is he having difficulty moving his eyes in a particular direction? Something like that. And then getting a better sense of, is this difficulty speaking a brain problem? In other words, he's having difficulty figuring out what words he should say, or does he know what he wants to say, but his mouth, his tongue, his face is not getting coordinated in the right way to actually articulate the words correctly, because aphasia and dysarthria are two different things. So that would be the high level discussion of how I would approach this. So a patient like this would get vital signs, a neurological exam, and probably an urgent head CT or an emergency head CT in the ER to rule out a bleed in his brain.
All right. Well, again, ask and you shall receive. All right. So vital signs, including blood pressure, were normal. The patient appears worried, but comfortable sitting in bed. He's moving all of his extremities well and has no apparent motor deficits affecting speech, though he has persistent word-finding problems when asked to respond verbally. He's able to give a history and answer questions using pen and paper. A focused eye exam reveals diminished visual acuity, corresponding to a 25% loss of vision compared to normal. Visual fields and color discrimination were normal. He has no papilledema. Eyes were not injected. They were normally reacted to light, and he has normal ocular motor function. The remainder of his neurological and aspects of the physical exam were unremarkable. His CBC, CMP, and infectious workup were all normal. Urine tox screen was negative for amphetamines, cannabinoids, and opioids. A lumbar puncture was performed in the emergency room and showed no abnormalities. CT head was normal. Thoughts?
So if I heard correctly, just to make sure I collected everything that you said, his vitals were normal, and the only thing they had on exam was a decrease in visual acuity, meaning his vision was not as sharp or as clear, but the rest of his neurological exam was normal, which sounds like, I mean, I don't know, did his word-finding difficulty resolve? Is that what?
Nope, just the word-finding difficulty persisted, the expressive aphasia, if you want to call it that. the, again, visual acuity for our listeners at home, that you use a Snellen chart, right? You know, those things where you can read right to left, top to bottom at usually at 20 feet. So this one was a 25% decrease, meaning that he could not, compared to normal vision, his ability to read those letters correctly was decreased. But he was able to move his eyes normally.
Yeah.
He was reactive to light. Motor function was normal. Just a decrease in vision. And again,
And it was in both eyes.
Correct. Bilateral.
Okay. So both eyes are not seeing as clearly, but the function of the eyeballs moving around in space and everything was normal.
Correct.
And he was having this kind of odd word finding kind of difficulty, nothing else. And they did a scan of his brain. There was no bleeding.
Correct.
They did a lumbar puncture, which sounds like it was non-inflammatory, which is good. And his labs, including importantly, his blood sugar would be the most important lab that I'd want to know on his chemistry's blood sugar was normal, as well as presumably various other electrolytes, sodium and calcium and things like that can also cause screwiness with this kind of stuff.
And urinary tox screen was also normal.
Okay. Tox screen is not a super useful test in general. I don't tend to use them very often, and they tend to miss a lot of things, and they can cross-react and get a lot of false positives for whatever that's worth. So, this is interesting. The hypothesis of a vascular problem or a stroke or something like that would probably not be enough to fully explain everything that's going on here. The visual acuity, the bilateral, both eyes being, you know, affected with a decrease in visual acuity suddenly is a bit odd for a neurological syndrome, assuming that his eyes are like well aligned. He's not seeing double because his eyes are like not able to coordinate and move correctly. And that tends to be much more of like an actual ophthalmologic problem, a problem in the eyeballs relating to his, you know, his lens or his, you know, the run of the mill stuff. Like we both have terrible vision, that kind of stuff, but that doesn't tend to be sudden either. There are things like high blood sugar that can impact your vision on a shorter term basis like that. For example, retinal, you know, pathologies, retinal detachments that are tend to be more dramatic. So some of that's a bit odd to explain this. So stroke in this case has not been like fully ruled out, just that he's not bleeding into his brain. You'd still want a brain MRI to look for evidence of a stroke. Other problems like this does not fit the presentation of a seizure disorder necessarily. There's been no trauma to his head to contribute to this, like a concussive type syndrome or something like that. And then the weirdest thing, like one of the weirder neurological conditions that we, when we get to the bottom of the barrel and we're like, well, we've ruled out everything else, we'll just call it a complex migraine. That that tends to be something that happens because migraines can present with all sorts of weird kind of phenomena, visual things, word finding things. You can even have something called like an acephalgic migraine, like a migraine without a headache, which sounds contradictory, but in fact, it is something that's possible. And so overall, I think the head CT being normal is great. The labs being great, normal is great. The lumbar puncture, great. That's all quite reassuring. The next things that I would want in somebody like this would be a closer eye exam by somebody who is better at eye exams than me. So like an ophthalmologist to deal with what's up with this visual acuity thing. And a brain MRI to better assess for the presence or absence of a stroke, which then would also potentially prompt further evaluation of his vasculature, his blood flow to his brain and things like that.
All right. Well, I can help you out. Unfortunately, opto's out. They're not in the hospital anymore, so they can't get a dedicated eye exam. They said follow-up outpatient. So best I can do for you is a brain MRI and a MRA. So MR angiography of the head and neck. The MR angiography was normal. So nothing.
No dissection, no atherosclerosis. Great.
Brain MRI showed extensive gray and white matter edema affecting mainly the parieto-occipital lobes bilaterally. There was no evidence of hemorrhage, however. Any thoughts here, Austin?
That is, so this is, I think, definitively in the realm of neurology territory and expertise, which is a different specialty. Now I feel like I've gotten close in terms of localizing where this problem lives. So extensive brain edema, that is unusual to see, especially in somebody of this age. I think that I'd still be worried. With a normal lumbar puncture with no evidence of inflammation there, some form of infectious problem going on there is very, very unlikely. I think that, you know, a lot of times when patients come in with these acute syndromes and they're young, like toxic ingestions of some sort of a substance is like typically the leading hypothesis that we have. So I'd probably be going back and reviewing a bit more of what sorts of exposures could have been going on or used, abused, supplementation, things like that. You know, when I think about brain swelling and things like that, one of the weird things is like weird vitamin A overdoses and things like that can lead to stuff like that. What if he's been, you know, going hard on some vitamin supplements? But this is definitely, we're well past actually the point where we would have some consultation with a specialist with expertise in this area, namely a neurologist, to better, because the finding of brain swelling on an MRI is not a diagnosis. It's just a finding. And that would have a lengthy, just like you've heard me talk about, like this patient had chest pain and I gave you all the list of things that can cause chest pain. What are all the things that can cause brain swelling? I can hazard I can start to make a list, but my list would be incomplete compared to the list of a neurologist. This patient doesn't have any of the metabolic abnormalities that I would expect that could lead to brain swelling. He doesn't have anything inflammatory in his cerebrospinal fluid that I would expect to lead to a brain swelling. So this is definitively like a pretty weird case. I'm still worried about ingestion, something toxic like that that's leading to this. My hypothesis of a migraine is off the table at this point. That would not explain this kind of thing. So I'd be going back to exposure history and getting some specialty consultation for what further testing needs to be done at this point.
Yep. So neurology was called. They came and weighed in on the radiographic and findings and the clinical picture, and they diagnosed this individual with reversible posterior encephalopathy syndrome, also known as posterior leukoencephalopathy syndrome. The patient was admitted for observation and blood pressure monitoring. Blood pressure remained normal and symptoms resolved within 2 days completely. Patient was discharged home and follow-up at 2 months was normal with a normal brain MRI with no persistent radiographic findings. So the pearls here are going to be about reversible posterior encephalopathy syndrome, which I don't know if you remember. I mean, I feel like this was like a third of a slide partway through medical school that you're just like, I'm calling neuro for that 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah, this is kind of an annoying diagnosis for a variety of reasons. I'll say, I mean, this is something I'm somewhat familiar with. It's not something I've seen a ton of, but it's commonly described as being a misnomer because it's called posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, and it does not have to have any of those things. It does not have to be posterior. It does not. It's like you just go down the list of things that you would think it will have, and it does not necessarily need to have those. So, this makes sense. This fits.
Yeah. Yeah. It is one of those things. Yeah. So this reversible posterior encephalopathy syndrome is an umbrella term referring to characteristic radiographic findings alongside neurological exam findings, including confusion, headache, visual disturbances that are often bilateral, seizures, and more. But to your point, one, it's not always reversible. Two, it's not always in the posterior aspect. Three, we're classically taught it's like only in the white matter, but it can be in gray and white matter, you know, both. So it's to your point, many people agree that this is kind of like a stupid term, but like, okay, I guess we're just calling it this. It seems to be related to cerebral blood flow regulation alongside endothelial dysfunction of those vessels. Specifically, there's increased cerebral blood flow from elevated blood pressure that can lead to hyperperfusion of the brain tissue, and like fluid and blood products can actually leave the vessel and enter the brain itself, causing these sort of dysfunction and the edema that was seen on the MRI. Now, most of the time, we're really good at adapting to changes in blood pressure, even during exercise, and exercise blood pressure can go up through the roof. I know one of the classic studies that we refer to is like when people were testing their one rep max on a leg press, their systolic blood pressure got into like 480 or something in one individual, where normal systolic blood pressure is 120. But in vulnerable individuals with endothelial dysfunction, so like those with preeclampsia or taking various cytotoxic drugs like chemotherapy agents, for example, they might have some sort of underlying endothelial dysfunction combining with high blood pressure. Well, yeah, sometimes this can happen. Now, classically, again, we're taught this condition affects the posterior brain regions, though that doesn't always have to be the case. But that's mainly due to some like autonomic and anatomic differences between the posterior and anterior circulations of the brain. Risk factors for this condition include high blood pressure, especially when that's combined with other conditions like lupus, renal failure, and again, taking certain medications, most commonly immunosuppressants, chemotherapy, other sort of cytotoxic drugs. Now, to your point earlier, and you went through extensive like differential building here, this needs to be differentiated from other sort of cerebrovascular conditions, including things that are infectious, autoimmune conditions that could affect the brain, malignancy, toxic exposures, to your point. It's almost like when you said the basement diagnosis or the bottom of the barrel, I was like, he's got to get it. Holy crap. He's got to get it. Cause that's kind of how I feel like that's where this ranks to me. But to your point, we would have already had neuro involved long before this. Cause you're like, hey man, I don't get it. Like I did all the normal stuff and nothing really makes sense. Any other ideas of like stuff you would want? Can you help me out here? Fortunately, the prognosis is pretty good here, usually reversing within days to weeks with removal of the inciting factor and blood pressure control. Recurrence rate is less than 10%. But my main pearl for this is not to like remember that reversible posterior encephalopathy syndrome exists. but that scary things can sometimes happen in the gym or just in life. And it's important to like not only stay vigilant, but also within your scope of practice. Imagine if this happened to somebody you were coaching in real life and you know, they're having word finding difficulties, visual disturbances, et cetera. Rather than being like, you know, hey, let me ask you about your feelings, or like what's going on. It's more like, hey, let's call 911. Let's get an ambulance here. Let's get you to the hospital. We gotta really want to take all the precautions here.
Yeah. Yeah, good case. And yes, a neurologist would be involved in this. I'll tell myself I should have gotten this one. However, as the feature that would have, I think, pushed me a little bit more in that direction, and this could be wrong on my part, but his blood pressure, you also said, was normal. Because when I asked for vital signs, I was specifically like, really want to know what that blood pressure is for multiple potential diagnoses that I would be thinking more about in somebody with hypertension, particularly acute hypertension in this situation, would have clued me into several possibilities, one of which would include press. But as we said, like nothing about the condition that you learn, like it does it have to have, and that includes high blood pressure as well. So it's a nebulous one for sure. But
yeah,
good stuff.
When they were writing this case up, I think they made the mention that probably due to the increase in blood pressure during exercise probably was mm-hmm. the inciting event here. But then when that sort of event was removed, effectively they thought his blood pressure normalized. But yeah, they still wanted to watch him for a few days to make sure that it didn't go back up again.
Yeah, sure. Having high pressure in your skull is not good for you. So
0 out of 10, would not recommend. Yeah. All right. So you're claiming 2 out of 3. I'm giving you 1.5 out of 3. But sure. I think that's still, I think your batting average is still pretty good. That's definitely, you're making the all-star team, might get voted MVP. So
cool, yeah, man. Well, that was fun.
Case files too. Well, I can't do the sarcoidosis one next time, but the next time we do these cases, I'm going to try to see if I can improve my, I feel like it's a battle. This is the existential battle. Like I'm trying to stump you and you're just trying to show like you can't do this. So
yeah. And you know, I could make the counter here and say that in order to stump me, you had to, you know, go outside my specialty, but that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, hey, next time, maybe some obstetrics related stuff. Yeah, we don't know. Some pediatric stuff. Yeah. Good luck. Yeah. Now that I found the recipe to success, you're done for. Very cool. All right. Well, hey, guys, if you liked this podcast, you like this format, please let us know. Thank you so much for listening. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for giving us his time. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.